dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the War of Ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. A man who has, well, extraordinary intelligence, let me just stipulate that at the outset, but who has both been in and actually given countless intelligence briefings is, I'm ecstatic to say, with us for a full hour today for a deep dive on a subject that he is one of our country's leading experts about, both from the perspective of the military officer that he has been until recently, serving as a member of the United States Air Force, rising to the rank of Brigadier General, a service of great distinction, a command pilot, among other things. His service to our government now that he is no longer in uniform, as a private citizen and extraordinarily influential figure. I'm talking, of course, about our very good friend and much admired colleague, Robert Spalding. Rob is these days a senior fellow at the Hudson Institute, the author of a relatively new book, an excellent treatment of the challenge that we're facing from, I believe, this time's existential threat to freedom. It's entitled Stealth War, How China Took Over While America's Elite Slept. He formerly served as a special assistant to the U.S. Air Force Vice Chief of Staff. He has been a strategist for the Joint Chiefs. He has been a member of the National Security Council, where he was formerly the Senior Director for Strategic Planning. And hardly least, he formerly served as the defense attaché to China, with service, of course, in Beijing. All of that, and a pilot too, an extraordinary man, great asset, a national treasure. In short, Rob Spalding, welcome back to Secure Freedom Radio. I'd like to spend a little bit of time helping our audience understand, as a matter of, if you will, open source intelligence, what you consider to be the single most serious impetus behind the stealth war that China is waging against us. Specifically, do you agree that it is the Chinese Communist Party that it is at the core of this challenge we're facing?
Yeah, I mean, if you read document number 9, if you read the Chinese Communist Party Constitution, if you read the collected writings and sayings of General Secretary Xi Jinping, if you actually understand what Deng Xiaoping was saying when he said, we're going to open up and reform, but we're going to hide our capability and bide our time, you really begin to understand the Chinese Communist Party has always seen the United States, not the country or the people per se, but the belief that universal freedoms were just that, universal. They've always felt that that was a threat to their survival. And so their goal is essentially to suppress those ideas, to suppress the U.S. Constitution. It is the Constitution, essentially, that document that says that all people were created equal and should be free, that really threatens their continued rule.
That is such a fundamental distillation of this problem, isn't it? That we are dealing with us as the obstacle to the realization of the party's agenda. And how would you characterize that agenda? Why is our Constitution, why is our respect for universal freedom such a problem for what China has in mind for the world, Rob Spalding?
Well, because their system, their social contract with the Chinese people is essentially to treat the Chinese people as subjects, but then to gain legitimacy by continuous growth of their economy. And they do that by essentially attaching themselves like a parasite to the free market economies of the world. And so rather than supporting the international order, which was based on democratic principles, free trade, rule of law, and self-determination, they have essentially just harnessed this idea of free trade as a means for dominating the economies, which allowed them to have enormous influence across all democratic societies to perpetuate their own rule, to bring jobs into China, to guarantee their continued control over the society. All the while, they're siphoning off the money, the profits for themselves.
I want to drill down on this bit about the money in a minute, because this is, I think, really the key ingredient to the whole program. But before we get to that, I'd like to just ask you about some of the aspects of what the Chinese are doing. And we'll start with trade. We'll start with, you know, their predatory trade practices, for example, that is so injurious to us and so instrumental to the realization of their global ambitions. Maybe, Rob, I found it to be particularly helpful, thanks in significant measure to the work that our colleague Rosemary Gibson has done with her book, China RX, to talk about as a kind of microcosmic example of how the Chinese engage in predatory trade, to talk about our dependence on them for medicine. Walk us through how this works, if you would.
Well, essentially what happened is companies in the West globalized their supply chain when China entered the WTO, because China encouraged them, incentivized them to do so. And so the entire goal was to create these massive profit margins that then they could essentially use to grow their wealth, while at the same time transferring all of the productive capacity of the United States into China. And so the challenge that brings is many-fold. One, we're seeing currently with regard to the coronavirus, is we can't get masks because they're produced in China, and China's banning the export of them. It's also the components that go into F-35s and other major weapon systems. And it's also the consumables that we use. And so in the Indo-Pacific, the fuel is produced in refineries that are beholden to the Chinese Communist Party. So as we began to look across industries and markets, we realized in the Pentagon back in 2014 that there was nothing that we could produce anymore if we had a confrontation with the Chinese Communist Party. And we're beginning to see it in stark terms today.
We are specifically, as you say, with respect to not just masks, but also medicines upon which we have become incredibly dependent. When we come back after a short break, General Spaulding, I want to just tease out a little bit further the thought process that seems to have operated here that made such a dependency unobjectionable. It would seem, especially in light of our present circumstances, to be anything but. How did this happen? That will be the topic A when we come back with General Spaulding right after this.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back. We are visiting for this full hour with a distinguished former military leader and now one of our great civilian authorities on the issue of China and the stealth war that it is waging against us. That is the title of his book. In fact, Stealth War, How China Took Over While America's Elite Slept. In general, that brings me to the topic that I wanted to get your further clarification about. The American elite that was sleeping in the case of, say, the pharmaceutical industry, like so many others in those sectors that were targeted by the Chinese Communist Party for essentially destruction, were presumably aware that as this was playing out, they were betting the farm that their sources of supplies from China would be reliable, would produce the quality of products that they were expected to provide in our market, for sure, and that it wouldn't matter that a nation with abundant reason to believe would be hostile to us, if not at that moment in the future, would somehow be a reliable supplier. Could you just try to help us explain how that all worked out in their heads?
Well, as the Cold War was ending, we had knit together during the Cold War this really tight free trade and democratic principle-oriented free world. So our allies and partners weren't just military allies. They were economic, trade, financial, and informational allies. We worked together. We grew our economies. We innovated. We shared that technology amongst the free world. When the Cold War ended, we basically brought China, Russia, North Korea, Iran into that globalized system, believing wrongly that if we gave all of that stuff to those regimes, that they would essentially democratize. And in fact, this has not happened. And so it was really this belief that, you know, not only were they going to get rich, and I'm talking here about the elites, but that we were going to have democratic principles prevail. And of course, the Chinese Communist Party doesn't agree with democratic principles. They don't agree with free trade. So they found this was an opportunity to spread their values into the system. And today they're dominant. They're dominant in the WTO. They're dominant in the UN. They're dominant at the World Bank. They're dominant at the Asian Development Bank. They're dominant at the IMF. And it's a challenge for us to preserve our democratic principles in that system.
It's interesting. I'm a little jaded, I must say, about the globalists and their commitment to democracy and the values associated with it. It seems as though it's mostly about the money and ensuring that they had a workforce that would be, well, cheap for sure, but also submissive to their directions. And if that was under communist principles, it was okay with them. It was going to be good for business, as they say, and the quarterly profits sense, at least, if not in the longer term. But Rob, there was a hearing yesterday, as you may know, that Senator Marco Rubio chaired in the Small Business Committee about the impact of the coronavirus, and we'll come back to that in a moment, but the impact of this turbulence that it has injected into our economy on small businesses. But it turned into a conversation with our friend Rosemary Gibson as one of the witnesses, and another old friend, Tim Morrison, who of course gained a lot of celebrity in the course of the impeachment hearings. But they were talking about how this is working out in practice, what it has meant to have our industries hollowed out, have our productive capacity transferred to China. And one of the things that Tim specifically alluded to, which I know is near and dear to your heart, in fact, you've been a national leader on it, both in uniform and since you've left the Air Force, is 5G. And he basically said to the committee, look, you know, this is a classic example of where they took us down. And now, as we realize that we've got to compete with them, we're hard pressed to have the technology or at least the ability to translate it into the requisite hardware and software and systems, networks that we need to compete with Huawei, the Chinese conglomerate. Could you just give us a short course on your thinking about the 5G situation? Is it exemplifies this problem as well?
Yeah, it's a perfect example. What happened was, as the iPhone came out in 2007, the U.S. still had an industrial economy. And in fact, Bell Labs, which was spun into Lucent, was one of the top telecom designers or R&D companies in the world at the time. And of course, as those networks, the 4G networks that powered the iPhone and the Android phone were built, the four major carriers in the United States spent $250 billion building those 4G networks. Well, what happened over the course of the ensuing 10 years was that Facebook, Amazon, and Google essentially took all the value out of the system by monetizing the data. They created algorithms that allowed them to power their platforms using the mobile platform of Android and Apple to power their wealth. And of course, in the process, it destroyed the telecom industry because they didn't actually pay back the $250 billion that they invested in the infrastructure. At the same time, the Chinese saw how we had come to dominate the global information economy, and they saw such power in Facebook, Amazon, and Google to influence our purchase patterns, our behavior patterns, and the power to use that for control over the population if they began to adopt that as a model for the next evolution of telecommunications, that is 5G. And so they have essentially be a direct strategy to destroy the U.S. telecom and international telecom industry so that they can essentially build the pipes of tomorrow, which is 5G, and displace Apple and Android as a platform because the computing is done on the network itself. And when they do that, Baidu, Alibaba, and Tencent will essentially take over for Facebook, Amazon, and Google. And then they'll not only be able to essentially control the global economy, they'll begin to influence people at the individual level, like we saw, like we continue to see every day with the Russians and Chinese around the world.
So where does that leave us? Have we, in fact, permanently lost the ability to compete on 5G? Are we doomed, basically, to a network worldwide, really, that is dominated by the Chinese? And if so, what would the implications of that be, General, as you see it in both the economic sense, but far more widely in the sort of strategic sense as well?
No, absolutely not. In fact, the Department of Defense has poured enormous money into research and development of telecommunications architecture and secure networking. And so the idea was basically to go to that research and development where we still maintain the lead in the technology and apply those to securing Americans' data. It was really about data. It wasn't about 5G. It was about using the opportunity that 5G presents to build a new superhighway for data that is secure and encrypted for the American people. That's what I worked on at the White House. And of course, because the telecommunications industry is so broke, and they saw it as a threat to their business, they essentially tried to squash it and essentially push me out of the White House. And so we have all the technology we need here in the United States. We have all the capability we need to build a secure, encrypted 5G network for the American people. The fact remains, though, that government is not taking a leadership role in this, and industry refuses to do it because they want access to Americans' data so that they can profit off it. So it's really about resetting the balance between the individual citizen and consumer, between the tech companies and the large totalitarian regimes that are taking in data and not only using it to make money for themselves, but also to slowly and subtly influence the population away from democratic principles.
There's another element to this which you've taught me about, and I think others as well, and I know this is a topic that's featured in your book, Stealth War, and that is this Internet of Things and the prospect that what seems like just some cool new technology opportunity to reduce still further, you know, our inconvenience in making things work by simply wirelessly commanding our dishwasher or our toaster oven or our self-driving car or whatever to do what we want it to do, relying on 5G technologies to communicate and order them about. But talk about the weaponization potential of the Internet of Things against us if, in fact, the communications networks are in enemy hands.
Well, you know, as I was defense attaché in Beijing, I got to witness what they were building there. And essentially, they have artificially intelligence-powered cameras nearly everywhere. And that's before the introduction of 5G. So 2017, you could order your food from your smartphone and then put your phone away, walk into the restaurant, a camera would recognize your face, and the server would handle you food and greet you by name. That's the world that 5G brings, the ability to disconnect yourself from the smartphone as the city watches you and then turns your actions and gestures and speech into a virtualized button pushes. So rather than calling an Uber, you can just walk out your front door, say Uber. A camera will pick up your face, do facial recognition, read your lips, and send you a car. All of this data is what China wants. They want the ability to monitor everything that you do. And by building an insecure network, 5G network. And when I say 5G, I don't mean just Huawei. All of the companies that play in the telecom industry now come together in an industry-making body called 3GPP to build the same network. It's not a different network. Qualcomm, Intel, AT&T, Verizon, Huawei, Samsung, Ericsson, Nokia, they all go to 3GPP. And today, the Chinese Communist Party dominates that standards-making body. They submit, particularly in security, 60% of the standards and the underlying patented technology. So when you see 5G today, if it's not secure, what it is essentially a Chinese network.
And not secure is something that we've watched these very technologies that could make you a virtual button pusher translate into something called the social credit system in China. The quantum computing, the artificial intelligence, the data mining, as well as the facial recognition and gait and speech recognition, and of course surveillance. When we come back, I'm going to ask General Spaulding to tell us a little bit about what that social credit system means for the people of China, and perhaps for the rest of us as well. Straight ahead.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
We are privileged to have General Robert Spaulding, United States Air Force, retired, in the house virtually, a senior fellow at the Hudson Institute, the author of a superb book, Stealth War, How China Took Over While America's Elite Slept. Man with a distinguished record of service in the uniform of the United States Air Force, and now serving, I think, his country admirably through the civilian side of our world, helping us understand particularly the threat posed by China. And I wanted to drill down with you, General, briefly at least, about something you sort of laid out there in terms of getting your Uber, but it's an ominous thing to have that data and all of that surveillance gear and capabilities in the hands of a totalitarian system, is it not? And what is it turning into, and perhaps in the context of this coronavirus controversy and struggle in China, but also perhaps for other nations to whom it might be exported?
Yeah, I mean, you hear all the time people say, the Chinese don't care about me, I'm a nobody. Well, as I talk about in my book, Roy Jones, a mid-level employee at the Marriott Corporation, working in the social media department, liked to tweet about Tibet, and the Chinese Communist Party called up Marriott and told them to deal with Jones and apologize. Of course, they fired him 3 days later and did issue an apology. And so the power of the Chinese Communist Party to put pressure on corporations is, and have that effect happen at the individual level already was in place.
Now, let me just make sure I'm clear about this. You're talking about an American who was working for an American company in the United States who was fingered in this way and essentially forced to be fired?
Absolutely. And as Samantha Hoffman, who's a researcher for the Australian Strategic Policy Institute, notes in her report, Engineering Global Consent, the Global Tone Communication Corporation, a Chinese company, a big data and AI company, which does language translation in 65 languages using machine learning and builds their technology into some Huawei products, collects 2 to 3 petabytes of data per year. Except that data doesn't just go to translating language. It also goes to the intelligence arm of the People's Liberation Army and the influence arm of the Chinese Communist Party. Now, how do these technologies get used in practice? Well, they're used to do things like in 2016, after the elections, 15 to 20,000 people marched to Trump Tower. Now, it seemed that those people were marching with a group called Black Lives Matter, but in actuality, it was the Russians using the technologies of Silicon Valley, big data, artificial intelligence bots, and social media networks to influence and begin that protest. Now, this influence extends via the social credit score down to each individual in China. As Baidu Alibaba and Tencent become dominant as global tech companies, they'll be able to create the same kind of influence on citizens everywhere as they use their consumption data, as they use the data they collect about them as they go around the city and interact with people. They'll be able to use that to subtly influence the way they think, you know, who they hang out with, what political party they like, what political system they support. We're starting to see the implications of this already in our own society as socialism and communism is actually making a comeback.
Or coming for the first time, in a way, in a mass level of support, particularly among younger Americans. This is chilling, needless to say.
Well, it's chilling because we built it. We built this thing. We built it. And the Chinese basically saw the wonder of this technology and these business models and said, wow.
And are bringing it to bear not only against their own people, but now others around the world, including ours. The interesting thing about this, Rob Spalding, as you may know, we did a national poll sponsored by the Committee on the Present Danger, China, which can be found both in the top line form and with the various subgroups, the cross tabs, as they call them, the demographics broken out as well at presentdangerchina.org. And we asked specifically questions about this social credit system and what Americans made of it. And there was generally quite a negative response, as one would hope, especially to the idea that this might be used inside our own country. So what you're saying here is, I think, going to be very chilling to a lot of our listeners. It raises another question that I wanted to just hive off onto, if I can, General. As you're looking at this kind of prodigious capability being built out across the globe, it's the digital infrastructure counterpart to something that the Chinese are also doing that is, I think, quite ominous, and that is building other kinds of infrastructure in nations from Asia to Africa to Latin America and Europe and so on. I mean, pretty much worldwide. Tell us a little bit about this Belt and Road Initiative, as Xi Jinping calls it. What is it? What is its purpose? And the potential implications of it if it reaches, you know, the full extent of their ambitions.
Yeah, I mean, it is literally the methodology by which they expand their digital authoritarianism model to create a digital economic prosperity sphere.
That's a term, of course, that the Japanese coined back before World War II, right?
Right, but, you know, that was more using military force. This is just using the power of globalization and the internet to expand their model into emerging economies. And so while developed economies are also under assault and their populations are under assault in terms of suppression of democratic principles, it's far easier for them to move into emerging market economies and do that first. And so it's really about growing their territory, their safe haven, if you will, by creating opportunities to get raw materials from these countries and then deliver products, manufactured products. They're expanding in Africa with low value added manufacturing. They've essentially created the skeletal system of a fully industrialized economy in many of their African partner nations. And now they're extending their information economy, just like, you know, as I mentioned, the change from 2007 to 2018, where we went from industrial economy to an information economy. China sees the power of these tools and wants to develop them. And it can do them by using the U.S. dollars to fund infrastructure through the Belt and Road Initiative, and also to use the digital Silk Road, which is really about the fiber and the undersea cables and the 5G networks that creates the platform for them to mine data.
Yeah. Let me just pick up on that last point, sir, because this is one of the most stunning things that I've come to understand since we began the Committee on the Present Danger China about a year ago and in the course of our many conversations with you on and off air. And that is, they are relying on our money to do so many of these things, the military buildup, the 5G predatory trade practices, Belt and Road Initiative, dominating space, you know, repressing their own people, and on and on. How are they getting that money, General Spaulding? And how much is it in play?
It's brilliant, Frank, and we're not ready to do it again with this coronavirus. Every time we have a crisis, we do what's called quantitative easing. We flood the banking system with money. We used to do fiscal policy, which meant we actually spent on things like infrastructure and factories. But today, because we have this globalized view of the financial markets, we basically push that money into the investment banks, into the banks of America. And those, and what has happened and what continues to happen is that money is then lent, or otherwise it goes into bonds or stocks of Chinese companies and ends up finding its way in China to build infrastructure and real estate and factories. And so that's what has been happening for them. And this is the thing that's so frustrating, because we're getting ready to do it again, as you have people that are working in the administration that only understand monetary policy. We've stopped using the Defense Production Act, an act which is designed to, force industry to actually be onshored for national security purposes. We've stopped using that. And I have fought the Defense Department for the last 5 years to get them to actually start spending on manufacturing, rare earth metals. Now we need pharmaceuticals, all of these things. And they've absolutely refused, because there's this fundamental belief that we ought to let industry do this. And what industry is going to do is going to take it to China, because they're incentivized to do so. The Chinese Communist Party pays them. It guarantees them high margins. And the people that are getting hurt are the working class and all Americans when you think of our national security.
There's another piece of this, sir, which I think dovetails with what you've just described in terms of quantitative easing and federal government and, money going to corporate boardrooms making decisions along these lines. There's also the phenomenon of our capital markets, which are also pouring money in much the same way into these Chinese companies. They're making their commissions. Not clear that they're making so much money for the investors, particularly the pensioners who are investing as institutions. But that money is also quite fungible and also quite enormously empowering of the kind of, rapacious build-out and colonial hegemonism of communist China. Rob, we have to take one last break. When we come back, I want to talk with you a little bit more about that, perhaps, but also to get your thoughts on what we should be doing now to deal with the Chinese Communist Party decisively, as we must. That and more right after this.
Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back to this fourth and final installment of an extraordinarily illuminating and, I hope, catalyzing conversation with one of our finest minds on the threat posed by communist China, General Robert Spaulding, senior fellow at the Hudson Institute and author of Stealth War: How China Took Over While America's Elite Slept. General, I was mentioning this problem of Wall Street. There's a very interesting piece, I think it's online at the Washington Post today, by its columnist Josh Rogan, who actually argues that these indexes, the passive investment vehicles that have become very popular on Wall Street, may be a bigger threat to our financial interests than even the coronavirus, which is causing such mayhem at the moment. Do you agree? And what are your thoughts about how this has come about and what we should do about it?
Yes, and this is exactly how the Chinese get access to the massive amount of money that the Fed and other central banks are pouring into the financial system. So essentially, the Chinese Communist Party put pressure on Morgan Stanley Capital International, which is one of the indexing companies, and they raised their coverage of Chinese companies from 0 to 20% over the course of a year, starting in 2018. And during that time, $400 billion essentially flowed from U.S. retirement funds into China. Now, they were taken out of stocks in companies. And so there's an interesting 10-minute video interview where Maria Bartiromo is interviewing Jay Clayton, the chairman of the Securities and Exchange Commission. I highly encourage people to watch that video, because what Jay Clayton says is that we have been pressuring Chinese to actually comply with audit and transparency requirements, but they refuse to. And so in essence, what happened is that retirement investment officers, like the chief investment officer of CalPERS, who was a member of the Communist Party's Thousand Talents Program, took money out of companies that were actually complying with audit and transparency requirements and put them into Chinese companies that weren't. Now, one of the things that Jay Clayton likes to say is that, you know, by allowing emerging market economies to have access to our capital markets, that will encourage them to be good actors, right, to comply with audit and transparency requirements. But yet the SEC has continuously allowed China to violate the rules. And Jay Clayton actually said that since I can't get them to do it, I asked the four major audit firms if they could help me. Now, imagine this, a member of the federal government asking industry to help them, help him protect Americans. This is abdicating responsibility. And the reason that the SEC doesn't want to do this is because of the enormous profits that Wall Street is making from the Chinese Communist Party and the pushback from the financial industry he would get and has gotten, and the administration has gotten by that industry when you tell them you're going to cut off access to for China to those capital markets. So this is a big problem that we have. It's endemic in our system, and it exists as a collaboration between the federal government and Wall Street to continue this practice.
Yeah, collaboration is a nice word for it. Collusion might be another. Jay Clayton, of course, being a Goldman Sachs alumnus, and there's some rumor that he's looking to go back to Wall Street, wants to come in on good terms. This is outrageous, I think, and especially one particular feature of this. You mentioned the Morgan Stanley Capital Index, international indexes. General Spaulding, as you know, you've written on this subject yourself. We are at the cusp of having, well, the retirement funds of people like yourself, military men and women, other government employees, past and present, in the thrift savings plan, going down this rabbit hole into these Chinese companies, putting you perhaps in the position of having to own stocks through the indexes of companies that are building weapon systems with which to kill people like you, your comrade, for that matter, the rest of us. I can't imagine this is going to sit well with those serving in the uniform of the United States. Do you think?
Well, I mean, they don't get a vote. The five-person board on the Thrift Savings Plan board basically decided that they were going to go along and they're going to send the military retirees money to purchase Chinese weapons. So, you know, this is what globalization has wrought. And I might add that it's not just Jay Clayton, it's also the Treasury Secretary, Mnuchin. He comes from the same community, right? So we have a problem in our system. This idea that we're just going to release capital to the financial industry, who is in cahoots with the Chinese Communist Party. We are never going to get manufacturing back in the United States. We're never going to pay for infrastructure. We're not going to do R&D because we don't do fiscal policy anymore. We only rely on the banking system. The banking system is under the control of the Chinese Communist Party.
And I think these capital markets more generally along those lines as well. General, I don't want to reserve the rest of our time, and it's not much, but in addition to not allowing the thrift savings plan to be put into this same kind of jeopardy for the beneficiaries as well as for our country, what else are you recommending be done now by President Trump or by our government more broadly to try to ensure that we win this stealth war rather than continue to see ourselves dealt defeat after defeat after defeat and possibly lose our country in the process?
Yes, the idea is to use the Defense Production Act, use Title III, use the authorities of the Department of Defense to begin to force investment in the manufacturing, use the purchasing power of the Department of Defense and the federal government to encourage only things that are made in America, use investment from the Defense Department to encourage investment in manufacturing, infrastructure, STEM education, research and development, decrease spending directly for weapon systems and in focus on building our economic and industrial base in the United States. Focus on building a secure nationwide 5G network using the same authorities and really get back to building this country. What I'm recommending, essentially, we did before. We did this during the Eisenhower administration. We built the Eisenhower National Highway System. This is how America gets back on track and really becomes an economic and a science and technological superpower. We can't do it by sending our money to China because they're building their own power.
It's important, I think, to take note that you're a general, former general officer, and you've just recommended that we stop investing in military hardware in order to have further funding available for these other purposes. I'd like you to elaborate on that as to whether you think that actually we can safely do that, given what the Chinese are doing with their own military buildup. But also, Rob Spalding, isn't it possible that we could be going to the Wall Street investors, or at least the American people who are investing through Wall Street, and say, how about investing in our country? How about putting that money towards infrastructure here or innovation here or research and development or otherwise enabling the rebuilding of our country as patriotic investors? Is that in the mix as well?
Yes, Frank. So, I mean, to be honest with you, Eisenhower, having come through World War II, understood the power of military to deter conflict. Okay, so he focused on deterring conflict and building the economy. And as he left office, he said, beware the undue influence of the military-industrial complex. Okay, so what we did back then is to focus on deterrence, to use, at that time, nuclear weapons as a deterrent. Now, we have the capacity to use nuclear weapons, but also build a lot of cheap conventional intermediate range ballistic and cruise missiles. This is why the administration came out of the INF treaty. So transform our force structure from a very expensive one operating in the Indo-Pacific to one that's a lot more efficient and effective in terms of providing deterrence, and then focus on investing in the economy like we did during the Eisenhower administration. Essentially, what we realized at the Pentagon when I was working on the strategy is that we had gotten ourselves into the position of the Soviet Union in the Cold War. And so we're bankrupting ourselves, Frank, like trying to meet the Russians in the fold the gap in Europe when they had an enormous conventional superiority. We would have bankrupted ourselves. We would have bankrupted Americans. That's exactly what the Chinese are forcing us to do. So all of these calls to build, you know, a 400-ship Navy, it's all designed by the Chinese Communist Party to get us to spend ourselves into bankruptcy. And, oh, by the way, have most of the profit from that go to China because they're supporting our war machine.
A fascinating point at which to end, General, and thank you for your time today. General Robert Spalding, it's always edifying, often frightening, but very illuminating to talk with you, and I hope we'll have a chance to do so again. Check out, in the meantime, folks, Stealth War, How China Took Over While America's Elite Slept, and follow General Spalding's work at the Hudson Institute, where he is, of course, a senior fellow. Stay well, my friend. I mean that literally as well as figuratively, and do come back to us soon. I hope the rest of you will do the same again tomorrow, same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.